Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Welcome to Crime Capsule. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. If you've been listening to the show for some time, you know that we occupy a unique place in the landscape of true crime media. We're not law enforcement, tackling tough cases firsthand. Nor are we attorneys or judges assessing those cases from the courtroom or the bench. We're historians, writers tasked with telling the story, of gathering the threads of fact and weaving those into a tapestry for all to see. The task can be arduous, tedious, frustrating, but the responsibility is immense. The responsibility to victims, to investigators, to the truth of the story itself, even when that story is difficult, if not impossible, to tell. Almost a year ago, we began this show, and for all those months thus far, we have presented the finished tapestry, the published book. Today, however, on this special bonus episode of Crime Capsule, we wanted to pull back the curtain and show you how the loom works, how the shuttle flies, how a writer and an editor together create the warp and the weft of the final garment. A how-to episode. And to spice things up, we've chosen a book whose difficulty level was set to 10. An unsolved case, a case from the 1970s in San Francisco that has stymied law enforcement for decades. Some cases, like some books, are open and shut. But the case of the Doodler murders has chapter after chapter that remains unwritten. To tell that story, and to tell the story of that story, we are thrilled to have Kate Zeliznok and Laurie Krill here to take us through it. Kate Zeliznok is a Bay Area-based writer and editor, and the author of The San Francisco Doodler Murders, published this month by the History Press. Laurie Krill is an acquisitions editor at the History Press, who first picked up the manuscript and steered it through to completion. Our next regular season of Crime Capsule will begin in a few weeks, but for now, enjoy this special two-part bonus episode on a killer whose name you may have never heard before, but which now you'll never forget. Kate, Laurie, thank you both so much for joining us on Crime Capsule for this bonus episode, and congratulations on the publication of your book. Before we get started, would you just introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Kate Zeliznok, and thank you so much, by the way, for having me on this podcast.
Pleasure.
I'm from the Bay Area. I live here. And my background is primarily in the arts. I'm an art consultant and a writer who's focused on the arts in the past. This is my first true crime book. It's always been a passion and it's always been a dream. So when the pandemic hit and time opened up to do it, I made it happen.
Yeah. Congratulations.
I'm Laurie Krill. I am
an acquisitions editor at the History Press, which is part of Arcadia Publishing. And I work on a lot of different books, but true crime is one of my favorites. And I was really excited when Kate came to me with her idea. And it's really great to see it as a finished book.
Well, thank you. Today, we're going to talk not just about this case, the unsolved murders in San Francisco in the mid-1970s, but we're going to talk about the story of the case, the research and the writing of this book. Call it kind of a how to write a true crime book as much as we're looking at the crime itself. Kate, I'd like to start with you. What is your connection to this case? How did you first find it?
Well, I had heard about this case very briefly in a conversation a couple years ago with a coworker. And it was then during the course of a conversation of talking about a lot of things that happened in, you know, San Francisco, unsolved cases. So when the opportunity came up to send Arcadia some pitches for different books, is when I really looked into this case more. And it turns out that I used to live across the street, literally across the street from where these murders began. I used to live on Ocean Beach. I could look out my window and see where this whole thing started. So when I looked at it more in terms of shaping a pitch for the book, what was really important to me when it came to tackling my first case was that I knew the area. So I was really familiar with just the layout, just little things that, you know, if I'd never been there, I wouldn't know about it, right? So the connection really came from wanting to find a cold case that was a serial killer and wanting to find a case that was in the Bay Area that was accessible to me. So that's kind of how I found out about it. And the other thing that was really important to me was that I found a case where marginalized victims were involved to, you know, have an opportunity to try to find some justice in those cases. And this one I thought was a really great opportunity to try to do that.
I have to say that I'm originally from California. I live in Charleston now for work, but I had never heard of this case and I only lived 3 hours from San Francisco. So, you know, I think that there's probably, I think one of my favorite things about Kate picking this case was highlighting something, both the marginalized community and something that like I had never heard of, which made it like doubly interesting for me because this is where I grew up. So the fact that I hadn't heard of this and she was really interested in making those connections and highlighting something that had been overlooked, like that was a really important consideration for me when she came to me with this idea.
Yeah. Laurie, tell us, how did this story come to find you? What state was Kate's manuscript in when you first started working together?
One of the coolest things about working in nonfiction versus fiction is that like oftentimes when people come to me, there's no manuscript. Like what we're looking at is the kernel of an idea that will grow into the book. And so I'm kind of able to help guide the book from its first draft, you know, opening chapter, what we want to cover in the book, what's important to cover in the book. And then Kate really gets to kind of build her framework, get feedback if she needs it. And, you know, we kind of help the book come together together. Like it's not an endeavor that she had to undertake and then, you know, try to figure out how it was going to fit with our publishing company, because every publishing company is a little different. We all require different things. There's different things to consider beyond just the content when you're evaluating whether a book is going to fit with a company. So for us, it's great to get in on the ground floor before the manuscript is done.
It sounds like a very symbiotic relationship in that, you know, Kate, you might be teaching Laurie about, say, the material, the actual contents and the details of the case. And then Laurie, you are there, you know, guiding, shaping and directing the flow of the larger narrative, kind of crafting it into a more substantive account.
Yes. In some cases, I have to say, like, Kate obviously is very talented. Like, she's a great writer. So I didn't have to worry about that kind of stuff, like line level, like whatever. She was doing a great job. So my job was more coming in as a reader, as a cold reader, like, I don't know this case like she does. So I'm able to point out things where I'm like, I don't really think I'm following your train of thought here. Can we bring this out a little bit more? Can we connect these two things a little more strongly so that you, when your reader picks up the book, they're able to follow the thread of your train of thought. And that's one of the more important things that I do, is just kind of making sure that when you're writing a book, like, you're in that world so much and you spend so much time there, you're so familiar with it, that sometimes you forget that a reader is coming in and does not have the same level of knowledge that you do. So you kind of have to step back a little bit and make sure that you're guiding them through the book, through the, you know, timeline that you've developed.
I'll have some specific questions for you about those moments shortly, Laurie, but for now, let's just jump right into what happened. The book begins with a cold open, as the filmmakers say, in 1974, when a body is found on a slightly remote beach in San Francisco. Whose body was it, Kate, and what had happened?
So this man's name was Gerald Earl Kavanaugh, and he had either gone to Ocean Beach on his own or was brought to Ocean Beach. All we know for certain is that at 1:29 a.m. the following morning, so that would, you know, January 27th, the call was made into San Francisco Police Department that a body was found on the shoreline. So the person didn't want to give their name, didn't want to get involved. So pretty much immediately, the detectives came to the scene and arrived just before Gerald's body was pretty much pulled out to sea. They had to kind of go into the surf and get him back to shore. He had been viciously stabbed a number of times, mostly in the back. So you know that somebody kind of, he wasn't expecting this. And he was barely mentioned in the press. There's very little that we know about Gerald because, frankly, his death occurred in a place that was a well-known cruising ground for gay men. There was sort of this attitude of, what was he doing out there in the middle of the night? Well, what do you expect if you go out there in the middle of the night? It's dangerous. You know, you're living a lifestyle that we don't approve of, that type of thing. So there was a lot of homophobia and a lot of disinterest in that murder in general, even though it was extremely graphic. I mean, this was a lot of frenzied stabbing, a lot of blood. And it really would have been something that made more headlines if, number one, I think if this were a straight man, but also number two, he was not the only gay man who was being found on these cruising grounds, murdered, whether it be by the doodler or someone else. Once I really started looking at this case, the overwhelming aspect of it wasn't so much just the doodler case. It was how many murders of gay men were happening at this time. And sifting through all of that information and all of those cases, Gerald might have been the first of the doodler, but he was certainly not the first gay man to be brutally slaughtered in San Francisco. So in 73 or 74, he was in the very beginning of 74. That's the first murder that we associate with the doodler.
And fairly soon thereafter, more victims begin to emerge. You write that there's a second, then a third, and then how many men were killed in total that we know of in that first wave of murders?
Well, there for about, let's see, 45 years, the number was five men who were associated with the doodler as a serial killer. This year, there has been as close to confirmation as you can get from law enforcement that a sixth victim might have also been involved in this case. So that hasn't been proven yet, but I've had it confirmed by SFPD, by the lead investigator on this case. Mm-hmm. So that is an instance, you know, that's a case that I'd like to hear some more about because it is, you know, sort of something they've just talked about. So the number recently has gone from 5 to 6.
And you write that there are a number of details that many, not all, but many of the victims share, such as there's some very interesting ones. Number one, sobriety, total sobriety. They're seeming...
With the exception of one.
With the exception of one, right, who's very drunk. Another one is a seeming lack of sexual activity prior to their deaths. And even the way in which the killer seemed to gain their trust only to literally stab them in the back. They were all attacked from behind. Not all, but the vast majority of them were. So what do we learn from these similarities?
So number one, I think that these men were targeted because with the exception of one, it seems that these were very closeted men. The majority of them were immigrants who didn't have a lot of, you know, family and friends in the area. It is the easiest thing, you know, if you're trying to pick a victim, you want to pick someone who is not going to be immediately missed or who you think is not going to be immediately missed. The lack of evidence of sexual activity that has been made public, at least, I can say there's nothing that's been made public, is probably the thing that stuck out the most to me in this case. It was something that I felt, you know, I needed to get consults from retired FBI, current researchers at the NCABC, which is the FBI's branch for victim studies of you know, violent crimes. Mm-hmm. That is not normal. That is very unusual for a serial killer to use a sexual lure. You know, all of these men assumingly went to these places with the intention of having some sort of sexual activity. Mm-hmm. So using a sexual lure to get victims to a place, but then not sexually assaulting them, makes this person a little bit of an outlier. So that's something that I talk about in the book a lot with, you know, through the guidance of other people with more expertise on these topics. That's the thing that I think unifies them all. And as you mentioned, with the exception of one victim, all of these victims were sober, which I found to be very interesting. So
what do we know about his MO? I mean, this is the point at which his nickname comes into play. And there's a sense in which we know a little bit about his method, but it's not entirely clear. So what are the facts in this case?
So there is the prevailing narrative that was presented, you know, as closely to fact as possible while these murders were occurring and for a long time afterward. And there is the newly, the reopened investigation of the cases that started in 2018, that started after the Golden Gate Killer was arrested. There were a lot of reexaminations of cold cases. So the Doodler name came out of several survivors who said that they had met this man in a bar or in a restaurant around the Castro. And he had told them he was an art student, but with one surviving victim, the Doodler approached this victim with sketches of animals. Mm-hmm. And started talking about, you know, his talents as an art student and how he wanted to get into commercial art as a career. From that story, from the sketches of animals shown to one surviving victim, has spiraled into a very specific narrative of the doodler approaching each of his victims at a bar, sketching a portrait of them, and that being his pickup.
Question for you about that later, but yes, please continue.
What current investigators have really looked into is the validity of that myth that he was going up to people and drawing them. In reality, the gay community during this period of time was not taking any of this lying down. The doodler was certainly not the only source of violence in the community. People were getting harassed, getting injured, getting murdered, getting assaulted, a lot in the Castro. So there were a number of organizations that banded together to form citizen patrols that were on the lookout. Multiple men were repeatedly arrested as potential suspects in the doodler murders. People were looking for this guy. So you really have to question, if that's the lore, how could he have continued doing it six times within, you know, the span of less than 2 years and not have that alert anyone?
Yeah, so I'd like to ask Laurie about this, because you have kind of an interesting moment where you have one thing that is thought decades ago. You have a revision to that notion, which comes much more recently. How do you balance that tension within the story as you're editing a manuscript like this? If misinformation is key to understanding how a case progresses early on, and yet by the end of the story, the misinformation has never been fully debunked. It's only been partially debunked. There's a little bit of uncertainty still surrounding it, as Kate says. How do you as an editor then sign off on what is known, what is unknown, and what is partially known?
Sure, that's a good question. So when you're building a story, there's always going to be a hook, and no matter if the story is true or not. And in this case, the doodler, you know, mythology that built around these murder cases really were what connected them all together for investigation. So it is still part of the story, even though maybe evidence of that is not, you know, available. It's still how the mm-hmm. whole, all the stories hang together. So it's something that's a narrative thread, but also, I mean, Kate addresses this very well at the end of her story. She's like, you know, all of these things were said to have happened. This is the evidence we actually have. You know, there is a possibility that there's even more victims out there because they were so focused on this particular train of evidence that we really don't know if it was true. So, you know, the police are expanding their search in terms of the type of murder that was occurred and the areas that they're looking at. So the police over time had to adjust their way of looking at it. And so the you know, as long as the book addresses that and helps the reader understand why we've moved from we're looking at this group of people to we're looking at this group of people, mm-hmm. then it's a great story. You still have fulfilled your obligation as an author of explaining to the reader how you got from A to B. That's really the important part.
I will confess to both of you that as I was reading your book, Kate, it is a page turner. It is absolutely a page turner. And as I was turning each page, I was waiting for the reproduction of one of these alleged doodles, right? I mean, I felt like that was it was the bait that I was getting ready to bite down on. I was sort of waiting for it, and it never came, and it never came. And then I realized there must be a reason for that. And there's a specific thing that I want to ask you about the California Public Records Act. But in advance of that, it became quite clear by the middle of the book that this telling absence, right, this felt absence in the lack of evidence that we as your readers get, had its own origin.
That was one of the first questions that I had about this case, was the same thing. You know, were these drawings recovered? Did someone, you know, at least have their portrait drawn. You know, let's just start there. And, you know, winding and weaving my way through research, it took a very, very, very long time for the SFPD to officially talk to me about this case. And that was a huge part of my discussion was, or agreed, both sides agreed that there is no evidence for portraits. So I wanted to, without, you know, first of all, I did not know that at the point. I was writing this book as the research came in because I wanted to write it in as linear a way. I wanted to go on this journey with the reader. So when I started writing this book, I started with the autopsies. I didn't start with any case file, any type of research that other people have done on this case. I started with the autopsies so that I could see what exactly happened and then worked my way out from there. And just as you're saying, you know, as you were reading the book, I had the same exact feeling. Well, when am I going to get to someone who can say, well, this is where it came from? And when I finally got to, you know, the end of the line, which is the current inspector on the case, said, we don't have them. It's not something that we have. And so we have to look outside of the preconceived notions that are around this, have been around this case for decades.
So let's go back to what we do have then. And one of the things that we do have, which is incredibly powerful in your account, are the small handful of instances in which this killer attacked someone who was able to either get away or who survived or who kind of screamed loudly enough that the neighbors heard and kind of intervened. And there are, by my count, there were three sort of primary survivors of attempted murder by this individual. Tell us about these folks.
We do not know their actual names. What we do know is one was a Swedish diplomat who lived in the Fox Plaza. We know the other one was a renowned public figure. Everybody in San Francisco or the Bay Area would know his name. And the third one is an internationally known entertainer. And that has spawned theories from, you know, a lot of people think it's Rock Hudson. You know, there's all types of, once you open that door of, you know, oh, if you knew his name, that's what the police said at the time. You know, they kind of teased the press a little bit. Well, if we said his name, everybody would know who he was.
You know, if we're in the mid 70s and we're talking, you know, internationally known, you know, stars, my bet's going to be James Garner. I'm a big Rockford Files kind of guy. So, you know, got to be James Garner, right? Has to.
Exactly. Everybody has, it's like with the Zodiac, everybody has their, you know, idea of who this person is. But we do know that everyone except for the diplomat has passed away. So unfortunately, we do not have an opportunity to get the accounts of the people who I refer to as the public figure and the entertainer. So the diplomat is the person who is still alive. And what happened was he is the man who was presented with the sketches of the animals. He was at a bar that was a couple blocks away from where he lived, the Fox Plaza. And he hit it off with this guy and brought him back to his apartment. And you know, they walk in. And this man asks him for drugs. And the diplomat says, I don't have any drugs. He said, okay. So he goes in the bathroom for 30 minutes, doesn't come out. Now I don't know what I would do if I just, you know, had somebody sitting in my bathroom for 30 minutes. So when who we now call the doodler came out of this bathroom, the diplomat said he was his whole face had just completely changed. He had a knife and basically he told him, I've done this before. I enjoy this. You people are all the same. And the diplomat was very clear. You people meant gay men. And so there was a lot of rage behind this act. We know that. He stabbed the diplomat 6 times before he was finally able to get away. And perhaps one of the most disturbing elements of this case to me in its entirety is that the other victim, the public figure, was also lived in the Fox Plaza and practically, you know, next door to the diplomat for all intents and purposes. To return to that building with another victim a matter of weeks, you know, after you've attacked the diplomat, that tells me a lot about this guy. To repeat such an intensely horrific act, to be so bold as to come back, almost to say, you're not going to tell on me. You're closeted. Mm-hmm. You're not going to lock me up. Because it doesn't just mean admitting, you know, that your true sexual identity, but it also means losing your job, losing your family. If you've already been through the trauma of being stabbed 6 times and narrowly surviving with your life. And, you know, the way I feel about it, if someone had taken that much from me and traumatized me that much, I don't know that I could add to that trauma by saying, I'm going to come forward and lose the support system that I really will rely on to kind of get through this. So there were 2 attacks at the Fox Plaza. In one instance, the other instance at Fox Plaza, someone was tied up and screamed and banged on the walls before they could be stabbed. And with the entertainer, with your international entertainer, the gist of his statement was that he was getting into bed with this man and a butcher knife fell out of his sleeve and clanked on the floor. And the guy immediately ran out of the room. And thank God he did, because, you know, he probably would be the 6th or 7th, you know, victim had he not.
Yeah. It's a small red flag. It's just a tiny little red flag when a butcher knife just shows up like that. I mean, you know, you might have cause to worry.
Yeah, that's kind of what happened. And these 3 survivors occurred after at least the 5 murders that we know. So if this is indeed the same man who killed Gerald and those subsequent men, if he's the same person who attacked these other men in their homes, you know, there might have been a progression of leaving these guys out on the beach. They're completely blood-soaked, absolutely horrific scene. I'm not getting that much attention. Nobody's really looking for me. I feel like you up the ante by starting to go in someone's home, trying to, and there's still no sexual activity. Now, maybe that's simply because these people got away, but the coming out of the bathroom with you people are all the same. Those are kind of indications to me that there is something bigger going on that is tied to and at the same time outside of a sexual motivation.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. the thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering?
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp.com/fruit.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
And hi, true crime fans.
We're the co-hosts of She Goes by Jane. Every week, we'll be covering the story of a missing or unidentified woman in the United States.
Stories you may have heard before.
And ones whose stories didn't make it into the news.
We've been covering these stories for a while, first in Amy's book of poetry, Doe.
And then in Vanessa's documentary, She.
But now we want to share them with you here on She Goes by Jane.
And each week we'll be joined by a special guest who will read a poem in honor of the women we talk about. Can we say who?
We can say who. We'll be joined by actresses like Coco Jones and Gabrielle Ruiz.
And musicians like Stephanie Quayle and Kelly Moneymaker, along with authors like Louise Penny
and Catherine McKenzie.
So check out She Goes by Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or check out Evergreen Podcasts and their true crime channel, Killer Podcasts.
We can't wait to bring you these stories.
You know, there is a terrible irony here that you point out, which is that for these survivors, even though their own lives were nearly ended, they still felt like they could not speak publicly about what had happened for fear of destroying their own lives in terms of reputation and that sort of the public shame as being outed, you know, if they were in fact closeted and so forth. And it's this just really gripping moment in the narrative where you realize that the human cost of these incidents is in a sense greater than the body count, right? And we, sometimes we condense murder narratives to just a body count one after the other. And we have to be very careful about doing that. And I think your observation about the stigma that was still attached in this time, even as the gay liberation movement was really gaining steam, was so spot on. Now, I want to shift gears to talk about context and about research for a minute. And I want to bring Laurie in on this question. The Doula Murders offers an incredible amount of insight into the time and place of its case, right? The 1970s, the emerging gay rights movement, the rise of gay activism in California, the Bay Area, the other serial murders happening at the time, the Zebra, the Zodiac, and so forth, as well as the context of the conflicts with the San Francisco Police Department and the tensions between officers, law enforcement, and members of the gay community. All of this is part of the narrative. In fact, these aspects are central parts of the narrative, and the story could not be told without them. But before we return to the sort of progression of the case, Laurie, the question that I have for you is, how and when did this digging into the context of the murders emerge in your conversations with Kate? And to what extent, as an editor, are you always watching out for the need for this kind of meta story, right? The story outside the basic narrative of that growing body count and the hunt for the killer?
So in this case specifically, Kate and I started talking about it when she first brought this case to me. Because as someone who works on a lot of true crime books, I'm very aware of the, you know, potential exploitation of the worst moment in someone's life. And it's really important for me. I'm a true crime aficionado too. I love reading those books. I love listening to the podcast. So, you know, sometimes I question, like, am I getting the right story? Is this important for me to know? And so for me, I really want to see my authors, and Kate does this very well, putting the victim first. So in order to tell the story of these, you know, this guy committing this horrific crimes, we have to know who the victims are. And, you know, it's a big part of why he chose them and why there were so many victims is the culture that they were in at the time. And, you know, Kate was very aware of that from the very beginning, is that one of the most important pieces of scaffolding that we have in this book is the, you know, the gay community at the time in San Francisco and all of the distrust that they had in law enforcement and the general population just not accepting them. And the very valid reasons that they might have for protecting themselves versus going to the police for help. So we knew from the very beginning that this was going to be a big part of the story. And Kate and I talked about how important it was to really showcase that in terms of the entire community being involved and being, you know, potentially targeted by this particular serial killer, because that was part of his, you know, MO. That was part of what he did, is target this specific community. So we needed to see who those people are and what was important to the victims and their community so that we could know them, because they can't tell their story anymore. You know, you have to be really careful about glorifying a crime that the, you know, the person who was most hurt by it doesn't have a voice in it anymore.
Kate, what was it like for you to have to travel back in time 50 years to bring this context back to the present, that San Francisco and the Bay Area have changed so much in that time? It's almost unrecognizable, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. The thing it was that, like I said, I really wanted to go in as tight of a chronological order as possible. I thought that working backward and trying to say, okay, it's this way now, how were things back then, would just be too overwhelming for me, right? So starting in 1974, I, you know, wasn't just looking at for coverage of these murders, which was very scant. I was reading all of the publication, especially the San Francisco Sentinel and the Bay Area Reporter, which were the two main LGBTQ publications at the time. So those, reading through those in their entirety as these times were going, it wasn't just even the stories, it was ads for different bars, a lot of ads for different celebrations. So you get a feeling of what's going on. You get a rhythm of, okay, this is, you know, this is sort of what the vibe is while this is occurring. Because in those publications, you get a lot more coverage, obviously, of all of the other crimes that were going on. You get even interactions with law enforcement. There was a man, Sergeant Blackstone, who was on, I believe, the homicide detail and wrote a column for the Sentinel in which he would answer questions that people sent in regarding, you know, the relationship between the gay community and the police and things like that. So honestly, those two publications, and I say this in my, you know, acknowledgments, this book wouldn't exist without them, because they did such an incredible job with making sure that their readers got a huge range of information. You knew the best place to go see the latest drag show, and you knew that somebody, you know, keep an eye out because there were three attacks on 18th and Castro, you know, last night or whatever it was. So that in combination with really, I am forever indebted to the GLBT Historical Society, which has been around for decades and decades. They are absolutely essential to researching the gay community during the period of time that these murders occurred. So really it was deferring to, rather than me trying to learn it all. There is no learning at all. I wasn't alive then. I, you know, there's no way. It was a matter of piecing together who I could find that did have that knowledge, that did have that experience, and did have that database of just knowledge that I cannot have. And so a lot in the book is me highlighting the work of people who again, have that experience and have that knowledge. Because I think if I would have tried to go about it simply as let me go backwards and just kind of what would I feel like if I wasn't, that's not going to work. You know, if trying to put your, a lot of times in different cases, you know, you could try to put yourself in the shoes of the victim or even the shoes of the killer or any of that. I don't have any of that. So I really needed to be resourceful and make sure that I was in contact with the, you know, authorities on the history of that time in that community.
One of the themes that is emerging as the two of you are meditating on this is access, right? It's access to certain kinds of information and what we have available to us, what we have to go in search of, the balance between discovery and common knowledge, or kind of that sense of a tension between what is known can be found and what remains unknown. One of the key sources of tension in your book, and this is a question really for both of you, is the tension regarding what I believe in the very first paragraph of the entire book you call the bane of your existence, which is the California Public Records Act and your effort as a researcher to gain access to files which remain sealed. And they remain sealed, of course, for good reason in some cases, but in other cases, you say you're having to sort of wage this repeated series of battles in order to, you know, to learn what you need to learn in order to tell this story. Tell us about the CPRA and your very complicated relationship to it, Kate.
Yes. So basically, for anyone who's never had the pleasure of trying to figure out how to get information through this act, it has blanket coverage for anything that is still under investigation, which means if I go to the LA Times from 1975 and there's a booking photo of someone, even if they were later convicted, right? They'll say, for some reason, well, we can't, because that would show the course of the investigation as to how we got that guy's booking photo. I'm like, but it's in the newspaper. You know, I don't understand. There's a lot of information like that will be printed, that will be out in the public. And you'll say, hey, can I get the official records on this? Can I get the official statement on this? Can I get a photo that you've already released to the press, but I can't use it? It's grainy. It's from 1970. There's no, I can't, you know, I don't have access. And in these cases, a lot of imagery, a lot of statements only exist in these microfilm rolls that, you know, hopefully stay together for a while, because that's pretty much it. So, every time I turned around, there was some reason as to, and it was almost always, well, it's tied to an ongoing investigation, and it doesn't matter if it's been made public or not. So my frustration is it's really misleading to call it the Public Records Act, because there are a lot of things that are public that they simply won't give you anything official on. So that is a true joy. But what I sort of found out, well, I had better luck with the Freedom of Information Act request. At least, you know, they would show me that they had reviewed the request. You know, when you get something back for a Freedom of Information Act request, it will show you, we looked at this, we can give you this, we can't give you this, this part's redacted. Mm-hmm. I would just get a no. From California. So what I wound up doing, and it's taken a lot of time, and there's actually still elements of different things that I'm in conversation with law enforcement about that just couldn't make it into this book, maybe the next one. I just felt like the most efficient way to sort of get out of this loophole was to find some contact in as many jurisdictions, and there are multiple jurisdictions that I talk about cases in this book. It's not just San Francisco. Get those contacts, try to just inch your way into a phone call. Email's great, but if you can get somebody on the phone, explain, this is who I am, this is why I want this information, could you, you know, put the right request into the right person? So I sort of gave up on a lot of the Public Records Act attempts, unless all else failed within a jurisdiction, then I'd say, send it in and I'll get the no that I already know I'm going to get. There's a lot of technicalities that you have to kind of just learn and accept.
Laurie, in your role, when an author comes to you with these kinds of obstacles, how do you navigate them? What options do the two of you together have?
Well, a lot, I'm not really deeply involved in the research, so I'll always, you know, offer suggestions. But the author's connections are really what sell the story to me to begin with. So Kate already had a really great connection to the Bay Area community, and she's already working on building all those relationships that she needed for this book and for the research she did. And, you know, I don't remember any specific conversations that we had, but I do know that I definitely encouraged your ongoing relationship that you developed with the police officers in some of your cases. That really worked out well. I'm pretty familiar with law enforcement because of my background. So it was great to hear that she was able to find some of those connections that were willing to talk to her and willing to discuss the case with her, because they could recognize like a mutually beneficial relationship in terms of like getting some light shined on this, on these cases. And she was really able to navigate those difficulties very well.
Kate, is there a particular area in which you really felt as though you were able to shine some light that had never been shown before in that respect?
Yes, I had a very cool moment that may or may not be related to exactly the Doodler case. I do talk about it in the book, though, because, like I said, when you really look at the number of murders in the general area of gay men, and it's insane. But I actually had a phone call with a sergeant on some John Doe cases, and it was one of those things. You know, sometimes as a researcher, you have a question in your mind. You go, I'm going to be the 800th person to ask this guy this. And he's going to be like, yes, no, we looked into it. No, it's not that. But something told me, oh, just ask, you know. And so I said, you've probably thought of this a million times, but have you looked into so-and-so? And you could just kind of feel this shift on the phone call. Because this suspect I mentioned, who I write about in the book, who a very prolific serial killer, still in San Quentin. So have you ever thought about him? He was in the area at the same time. And he had never been looked into. The current investigators weren't aware of who he was. And maybe it's nothing. But having that tiny moment of just that acknowledgement of, we didn't think about that. And we have DNA, and we can go back and look at this, and we can either rule it out or rule it in. That was a really huge moment for me. And it helped that the, you know, sergeant that I spoke with at length was saying how much he appreciates work that it's like the work that we all do, you know, is solid research and presenting facts and putting the work behind the story. And that it's helped with a lot of cases. Just that small connection of realizing that what I'm doing is important and can be helpful in a much larger sense than even the book.
Thanks for listening. Our guests have been Kate Zeliznok and Laurie Krill, author and editor of the San Francisco Doodler Murders, published this month by the History Press. To order a copy of The Doodler Murders, visit your local independent bookstore. Our Crime Capsule show page on bookshop.org or arcadiapublishing.com. Join us next week as we pick up where Kate and Laurie left off and the story of the story comes to a close. Crime Capsule is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with Arcadia Publishing and the History Press, and is a member of the Killer Podcasts Network. Thanks as always to our producer, Bill Huffman, our production director, Bridget Coyne, audio engineer, Ian Douglas, and our executive producers, Michael D'Aloia and Gerardo Orlando. Season 2 of the show will launch in a few weeks, so stay tuned. Until then, I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. To learn more about Evergreen, offering shows in every genre, visit us at evergreenpodcasts.com.
I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.